Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, teenagers come of age online and on social media. Nancy Jo Sales is the author of American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. The book is available in paperback on January 24th. Award-winning Vanity Fair writer Nancy Jo Sales crisscrossed the nation, talking to more than 200 girls between the ages of 13 and 19 about their lives online and off. The result is a chilling portrait of casual exchanges of nude portraits, normalized extreme sexual behaviors, and a virulent new strain of sexism. Nancy Jo Sales joins us from Manhattan. Nancy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is an important book. It's not necessarily easy to read if you have children, sons, and daughters. Do you feel a sense of urgency in parents especially reading this book and understanding its content?
I do, and the book came out in hardcover last year, and since then I've really been traveling around the country again, you know, giving talks. I'm invited to schools or organizations, and these talks have been very well attended by parents, and I think the reason is because their sense of urgency around the issue of social media, and not just their daughters but their sons, is so great. And I look out into these audiences and I see parents whose faces are just full of concern and sometimes real worry about things that have happened in their schools, things that they see happening with their own children, not just even in terms of the sexualized content and, you know, behaviors like sexting, but also social media addiction and the way that kids seem to be more and more tied to their phones and really sometimes unable to engage in real life.
Mm-hmm. More than 200 girls you talked to, what were some of those themes, what those girls were telling you as you researched the book?
I was very surprised and shocked sometimes about how much sexual harassment there was online and on social media for girls. You know, cyberbullying is a terrible problem in this country. We still have, even though we're all aware of the word, we know it exists, it just seems to have gotten worse. And teachers in a recent survey said that cyberbullying was the most important issue facing them in their schools because it often disrupts behaviors in the school itself and in class. And cyberbullying for girls often involves focus on their gender, their sexuality, whether or not they're this or that, you know, in terms of their choices. So that was one really big thing. There was, you know, this very casual and normalized, as you mentioned in your introduction, exchange of naked pictures, which I think that, you know, most parents are concerned about. It's become so normalized, and some people will even argue that it's just a new kind of flirting. Don't be worried about it. If you are, you're just a prude. And I really couldn't see it that way after hearing so many stories from so many girls about how these pictures are sent around and lead to kind of exposure, ruining of reputations, and really a lot of pain and heartache. And it leads to also a lack of trust between kids.
Let's talk about that word reputation, because if I go back to my teenage years, I remember my mother talking to me about reputation and scratching my head and thinking, is she serious? And now you see these girls who are managing their reputation online intentionally. Is that here to stay?
Well, I think we have to change the culture of social media, and I think that we can change it, you know, first of all, by talking to them about it. Reputation, I think, once upon a time had a very sexist connotation, which is, you know, is she or isn't she, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. Whereas now, it's as you suggest, it's become more even a sense of how many followers does she have? How popular is she? Girls spoke to me a lot about feeling this pressure to be popular via social media, to be a known presence, to have lots of followers and lots of likes on their photos. And for girls, unfortunately, the culture of social media is such that these likes and followers are often granted them when their pictures are sexualized, when they're posing provocatively, or when their life appears to be quote-unquote perfect, you know? Mm-hmm. And these are pressures that I think are just way too much, sometimes very overwhelming for girls and young women, particularly at very young ages. I mean, I think that we can all agree that we would like not only girls, but boys too, to be thinking about other things, mm-hmm. reading books, playing sports, doing their schoolwork, you know, having in real life conversations and interactions that are healthy and fun. And I don't think that most parents think that a good use of time for their daughters or sons is to be spending time thinking about how can I promote myself online? How can I be a bigger brand? How can I have more of a following? It's really an unfortunate turn of events that we see now that I think we've just got to start talking to them more about. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I interview many girls, and you'll hear many stories about just how deeply this affects them.
Do they feel trapped by their own sort of online usage?
Yeah, I mean, when I very first talked to a group of girls in Los Angeles, one of them said to me, and this was really unprompted by me, girls really brought me to the subject of social media. She said, "Social media is destroying our lives." And I said, "Well, why don't you just go off of it?" And she said, or her friend said, "Because then we would have no life." And that sort of set up the kind of case that I would see over and over again, where girls have a lot of negative feelings about the effects of social media, the things that are demanded of them, and yet they feel like very entangled in it because it has become teenage life. Hmm.
Does Silicon Valley and the folks behind some of the major social media platforms, is there a reckoning for them in this book?
Yes. I was really surprised when I started researching the book. I didn't know a whole lot about the tech world or about Silicon Valley, and I was surprised to learn in researching the book just how very male and white male it is. And again, I'm not trying to be politically correct to say there's anything wrong with being a white male, but when you have an industry that is so influential and so, so the focus of the lives of children and teenagers now, and when it is emanating from the imaginations of mostly white men, then you have to think about really what effect that's having on these platforms. I mean, one of the very earliest sites was one called Hot or Not in 2000. There's this idea that you look at a picture of usually a woman and say, is she hot or is she not? I mean, I think we can all pretty much agree that that's a very sort of sexist concept, and I think that it's sort of a Rosetta Stone for a lot of what social media is and how it's experienced by teenagers is this idea of, like, is she hot or is she not? And I think that that is sexist, and I think it affects the ways that girls experience social media. So I think Silicon Valley needs to hire more women, promote more women within their companies so that we get different kinds of apps that are not so image-based and not so, that don't, demand of girls that they give away their power and their validation to others, but particularly based on appearance.
My guest is the author of American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. The paperback is out this week. You can get the hardcover already. Her name is Nancy Jo Sales. And I'm wondering if there's any pushback from the girls, from teenage boys, from their parents, mothers, and fathers. Did you find examples of ways people were sort of reclaiming this and pushing back against it?
Definitely. Oh my goodness, yes. At every talk I've given since the hardcover came out, you have parents trying to figure out what can we do, talking to their kids, forming groups in schools to have to talk about it. I recently spoke at a school here in New York City, and it was just before the turn of the year, and the school administrator said to me that when they sent out it's a girls' school, when they sent out a survey to the girls saying, "What are your New Year's resolutions?" She said that over 75% of the girls after my talk said New Year's resolution is to get off social media or not use it as much. Hmm. So I think it's really a thing of awareness and consciousness raising and talking about it and realizing that this doesn't have to be normal. This doesn't have to be inevitable. We just need to start talking, examining our own behavior. Not only kids, but parents too. Sometimes parents are role modeling this behavior as well. A mother at a talk I gave yesterday said, "You know, we have to look at what we're doing too, and what we're showing them about how to live life."
Yes, there's some others in this book that, I'll say it this way, I don't really connect with them. Some of the mothers are participating in the sort of online bullying behavior and shaming of other girls.
Absolutely. And that's really something that is hard to talk about sometimes with parents. Yeah. But, I mean, I think that's unfortunate, and it does exist. There are moms, you know, probably dads too, although I've seen it more among mothers, who sort of see their daughters' online popularity as an extension of themselves, and even help their daughters to achieve online popularity by buying them followers, buying them, you know, getting their friends to like their photos and so forth. And also there were mothers, reports from girls of mothers in the book who would get involved in cyberbullying situations. And we've seen this also in some very high profile cases of, tragically, of suicides that have occurred, where girls have been what's called cyberbullied to death. It's called cyberbullified. It's sad that we have even a word for it. And sometimes there are adults involved in it as well as kids. And that was the case certainly in Steubenville. I mean, it didn't lead to a suicide in that case, but we know that the girl was sexually assaulted, video of it put online. And people in the town, you know, adult men and women became involved in the cyberbullying of this girl who was the victim of this crime. So I think there needs to be a reckoning for this among adults. If we want the culture of social media to change, I think, yes, we definitely have to look at our own behaviors as parents as well.
And let's end with this and go to the very end of the book, where you're sort of impacted by all these conversations you've had with girls and processing, and boys and parents, and processing all the information, and you sort of reach out to someone surprising for a touchstone. Tell us who that is. Who'd you call at the end of the day?
Well, what I heard a lot when I was reporting the book was, oh, it's always been this way. Well, yeah. That's just simply not true. I mean, the technology is unprecedented and has completely changed the way that we come of age. And I've heard so many school administrators say to me, sadly, there is no more childhood. It's just very different, the kind of exposure kids have online, particularly to online pornography. I mean, that's a huge issue that many people don't seem to want to talk about, but we really have to, because more and more I saw how much online pornography was a factor in the social media culture, and then what kids see and how it's affecting their sense of themselves and how they will be men and women in this world and how they will behave in a sexual context. So anyway, but I was sort of, you know, wondering, am I just getting too caught up in this research? Have things always been this way? Were things always like this? What were we like? You know, I was trying to remember, so I called my first boyfriend from ninth grade,
yeah.
And I hadn't talked to him in, decades, and I just wanted to remember, what was it like when we were kids? What did we do? How were we? What was being a girlfriend and boyfriend back then like? And he reminded me of a lot of very, you know, sweet, touching things we used to do. We'd walk home together and do our homework together and have long, long conversations on the telephone, of course. And I said, well, gosh, you know, this isn't something that I hear a lot about happening now. And he has kids, too, by the way. He has high school kids now. And I said, what do you think the difference is? And again, unprompted by me, he said, and he didn't really know a lot about my research, he said, I think the difference is porn. It's online porn. You know, it's really changing the way they see how men and women, boys and girls, interact. Now, it's so sad to me that this is the case. And this was part of the inspiration for this book, because I do think that if we want our kids to have normal, healthy, well, normal is a big, big quote-unquote word. I understand that what normal is to one person might not be normal to another. We want them to have healthy, let's say, and positive interactions with each other. We need to get them offline so that they're taking those baby steps to see what intimacy is, to hold hands, to have talks, to, you know, get to know each other before you send a nude photo. I gave a talk to some kids in Long Island recently, and I said, how many people in this room have ever held hands with someone? Not a single hand went up. Hmm. And then I said, how many people have sent or exchanged a nude picture? And, you know, don't worry, I won't tell your teachers. And about, you know, after some giggles and squirms, about half the hands in the room went up. So think about that. I mean, you know, naked pictures before knowing even who you are.
Hmm.
And so it's a different world, but I don't think we need to, you know, accept this as inevitable. I think this is, just like anything else, it's a new technological innovation, and we can change the way we use it. But it starts with a conversation.
The book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. My guest has been Nancy Jo Sales. Read the book, start the dialogue. Nancy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
SDPB TV brings you a full hour of social media conversation tonight on South Dakota Focus. With me in the studio now, South Dakota Focus host Stephanie Rissler and SDPB's social media engagement specialist Heather Benson. Stephanie, thanks for being in the moment with us.
Thanks for having us.
Heather, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Well, what sort of prompted you? I invited Nancy Jo Sales because Stephanie Rissler was doing a full hour on social media, which made me start thinking. I'm wondering where you sort of got the idea that you wanted to hang a focus around this topic in particular.
I think it seems to be something we're all talking about right now. I don't know if it was spun off of the fake news situation that happened with the most recent presidential election. But I think it is a discussion that people are having. And your last guest touched on a lot of things when it comes to our youth. But when it comes to us adults, there are a lot of questions. A lot of us are using Facebook. One of the statistics I found was, on a worldwide basis, 1 in 6 people have a Facebook account. Mm-hmm. So I got to looking at a lot of the different things that are circulating around us, our privacy settings, fake news, companies that are using our likes and our games and our apps for marketing purposes. Mm-hmm. And I thought, let's pull together some experts and let's do a show that can educate all of us on being a bit more social media savvy. So that's kind of where it came from. And we're going to talk about a lot of different things tonight, but the main purpose is, how can we be smarter with whatever social media, I guess, app we're using? Yeah. How can we help our kids use them a bit smarter? But there are some great benefits to social media, too. Heather has come into STPB, and she's really pushed us up the ladder in terms of our exposure on social media. And we're going to talk about some of those positive outlets, whether it's for marketing or just networking yourself. So it'll be a good conversation.
And Heather, when we were talking with author Nancy Jo Sales, she was talking about kids sort of building their brand in high school from a popularity standpoint. That's not necessarily a faulty skill. At some point, they're going to have to think about brand building and using social media in business in a more mature way. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the positive aspects of using social media to tell a story, to spread a message that you want to spread, they're beyond sort of people clicking on a picture because they think you're pretty?
Well, social media, I mean, it describes itself in its very term, social media. So what I always underline for people is, it's about building relationships. And there's just like in real life, there's a lot of different relationships you can build and a lot of different ways you can build that relationship. Social media offers us the unprecedented opportunity to connect with people that we'd never come face to face with, to have conversations we might not otherwise get to have. And being smart about how you do that starts the first day you get on social media, whether that's at 13 or 53. Mm. And kids today understand an environment unlike any of us adults. And I will be the first one to raise my hand. But what they don't understand is that never goes away. Even the stuff that's on Snapchat gets screenshotted and can come back to haunt you. And that when you're building your personal brand, whether it's with your friends or with future employers, you need to make a judgment call just as if you were in a room full of people that included your parents, future employers, your friends, and say, do I want this out there? Do I want everyone to see this? Is this something that is for the public view? Hmm. And I think that's probably the first most important conversation any of us can have is this something that I would have in a gymnasium full of my entire town, family, and friends? Or is this something I would only share with my closest confidant?
How fast is it changing?
On a day-to-day basis.
Day-to-day basis,
yeah. I can wake up tomorrow morning and everything on Facebook from me as a business partner in Facebook will have changed. And they don't warn you. And same goes for us as users. Facebook is a great example of constantly changing their privacy settings. You are not likely to be informed of that fact unless you're reading every piece of small print that Facebook sends you, and one day what you thought was completely private is now available to a myriad of marketers, a group of people you didn't know were out there. They do experiments on certain groups of people that they admit to, that they're test marketing things that they do. A big experiment that bothered a lot of people was they started removing either negative or positive posts in some users' timelines to see if they could affect our mood. So they're not just playing marketing games, they're playing psychology games as well.
Stephanie, who's going to be on the show tonight so we can really dig into this conversation on South Dakota Focus?
Well, Heather will be on, so we'll get to hear more from Heather. We've got Skylar Crable, and he is with a company called Epicosity, and he's their digital strategist. So he's working with a variety of businesses across the region on how to better utilize social media for marketing purposes. Carissa Cooley, she's from South Dakota State University, and she's with their Mass Comm department. She'll talk to us about how they've really shifted and they use social media when it comes to recruiting students, reaching out to students. But she's also part of, she's preparing a thesis that will look at social media and the impact it has on generation, I guess Y and Z is what she said. So we're going to hear more about this particular area that she hopes to teach next year. And then Dr. Teddy Joyce from the University of South Dakota will come on. And this is something students are studying. It's a career in the future, as we see with Heather, and we're seeing it right here in South Dakota.
All right. South Dakota Focus airs tonight on SDPB-TV at 8 p.m.
8 p.m. Central,
7 Mountain. Stephanie Rissler, thanks for being here. Heather Benson, thank you as well. Up next, world-renowned pianist Joel Fan arrives in South Dakota. He's in the moment after the break. You're listening to SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. World-renowned pianist Joel Fan comes to South Dakota this weekend for a recital brought to you by the Black Hills Chamber Music Society. Fan has played Carnegie Hall and the Kennedy Center. He's toured China and Cuba and South America. He's played with cellist Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. He also played for David Letterman. Reviewers have called him a champion of new music and in the company of the best. I caught up with Joel Fan in New York City. Well, he was calling from New York City, and I asked him what was on the program for this weekend's recital.
I'm very excited about what I'm playing. I'll be playing some of the great romantic piano literature, as well as some lesser-known works. And so we'll be starting off with Chopin's Polonaise Fantasy, Opus 61. And this is known as one of Chopin's absolute greatest works. It's only about 13 minutes long, but he's really plumbing the depths of emotion and philosophy, even in this work. And then I'm going to follow that up with the Brahms Six Pieces for Piano, Opus 118. And this also is considered one of Brahms's greatest works. And he wrote this at the end of his life. And I'd like to think of this particular work, these six pieces, they're very retrospective and they really look backwards. I feel that they're very reflective, and Brahms is almost characterizing the wreckage of his life. That's why I like to describe it.
Characterizing the wreckage of his life. That's interesting.
Yeah, the wreckage. Wow. You know, you look back and you're like, what could have been, what could have been better? And I feel there's a lot of that reflection in there. And it's a really, really deep and also, you know, philosophical work. And then I want to play some more Chopin. And so the overall the rest of the program is really, you know, great romantic repertoire on the piano. So the second half consists of some Chopin impromptus, which are shorter salon pieces. And then I'm going to then do this very interesting set of transcriptions by Liszt. Franz Liszt wrote several transcriptions of Chopin songs. Now, Chopin was primarily known as a composer for pianists. So, but he also did write some music for, you know, singers and piano, and Franz Liszt was expert at taking different versions of music and creating it for his own purposes as a piano soloist. So I'm playing two of these Franz Liszt Chopin transcriptions and followed up with a real show-stopping ending, the Mephisto Waltz number one by Franz Liszt, with a super virtuoso ending by Vladimir Horowitz, who's one of my favorite pianists.
So I have some kind of understanding of how a piece can be emotional and sort of plunge emotional depths. But when you say it plunges some philosophical areas, I have less of a grasp on what that means. Can you explain that to me? How can a piece like that be, or a composition, be philosophical in nature?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the questions of philosophy are like, who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing?
Right. Okay.
You know, these are questions that all of us have at some point in our lives, not necessarily all the time, but at least a few times. And I feel like these are the kinds of questions that both Brahms and Chopin are answering, you know, in their own way through their music. And you know, music is the, it's stuff that you can't describe in words. It goes beyond words. It goes right to the emotions. But the emotions themselves have very layered and deep, meaningful feelings.
So do you come at that because of your knowledge of the composers themselves, or do you come at that because you can hear it and feel it in the work itself?
It's because I can feel it in the work itself. I know the composers' histories, and I know about their compositional backgrounds and their other works, but not all their works are as, you know, light, are as heavy, I should say, heavy and deep. You know, so sometimes the works are much lighter and playful and spontaneous, as are these works as well. But these works do have the Opus 118 in particular has a real sobriety and a real sense of pain that's in there. Mm. And I can think about Brahms' own, you know, painful history or moments of pain in his life, and you feel that's in there.
So that a lot is happening for you as you play something like that on stage. You feel it, but yet you're also in the, you know, the technical aspects of playing it, which are very intense. There's an audience watching everything you do. They have to be in your mind somewhere, I would think. And then there's this great emotional sort of journey, if I can use that word, that you go through as the musician. How do you sort of handle that whole emotional human package that happens when you sit in front of the piano then?
Well, I think that what's wonderful about playing the piano is that it's always, you know, the same keyboard, in a sense. I mean, pianos are different, but it's the same experience you have, and you're recreating great music that was written 150, 200 years ago. And, you know, the audience is definitely part of the performance. You definitely incorporate them, you know, because I like to talk to the audiences. I like to, you know, describe what I'm looking for in music. But at the same time, when I perform, it's definitely a transformative experience. And I, myself, am just part of it. You know, it's almost like I'm part of it along with the audience. And it you just sort of, you know, do it. You know, one of the important things is also just kind of let it go and let it flow. Mm. You know, you don't want to be thinking about your training or about all the hours you practice. It's a performance, and you're there to have a good time and take the audience through this journey with you. And it's a really, really rewarding and ultimately exuberant experience for both the audience as well as myself.
Do you sort of give up your sense of self then once you get into it? Is there a sense of that when you talk about flow? What does that feel like?
Yeah, the music is what's important. You know, you're there as a conduit for the music, and you're there as the connector with the composer's intentions. Mm-hmm. And the composer who hasn't been alive for, you know, very long time, but you're there to communicate and to be this channel of communication. So it's a really wonderful experience.
A big responsibility in some ways, too.
Well,
because not everybody can do that. There are only, you know, how many people in the world can actually do what you do? And then, so I think it feels like a sense of responsibility and a gift as well.
Well, you know, I don't actually feel it as a responsibility because I feel almost that the music itself is so great. I mean, I feel so blessed to be able to play this kind of music and to bring it to life. And it's so, the music is so powerful that it almost speaks for itself. You know, in a way, it's actually easy that way. You know, because if it was really bad music, you'd have to work a lot harder to make something meaningful out of it.
Sure.
This music that we're so lucky to play as pianists, as classical pianists, it's so powerful that we are scratching the surface. And as with all great art, you know, there's always more levels and always more layers, and you can always peel the onion back a little further. And I think that that's what's so fascinating about the whole process is it's a responsibility, but really, really much more than that. It's you're just doing, you know, your role as interpreter and bringing this music to life.
I get that now. Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thanks for sticking with me on that one.
Good question, though.
Thank you. And the continuum, it is ongoing with new music and then music from cultures that, you know, you have access to now that maybe Brahms or Liszt really didn't have access to. Talk about sort of new music and world music and how that relates to your work and to the piano.
Well, I think actually this concept of taking music from different parts of the world, it's always been around. If you look back at the time of Mozart, you know, his famous sonata has a last one called Rondo alla Turca, or Rondo in the style of the Turks. So, you know, as far back as Mozart and even before that, you know, there's always been influences across different cultures. I think what's so unique about life today is the fact that we are all connected. You know, we all have these incredible computers in our pockets, and we're all connected across the world seamlessly. And we can get incredible diverse influences just by, you know, clicking on YouTube. So it's really a remarkable time in terms of creativity, in terms of innovation. And actually, I've taken some of these themes, and I'm starting a new festival in New York City called the Open Source Music Festival. And this music festival, it plays on the idea of open source, which I realized over the last 2 years has really dominated a lot of my life, you know, thinking about how collaboration happens and how new works are created building upon the works of others. And actually there is, even in this recital that I'm performing, there's even elements of that. Like, you know, I talked about the Chopin and Liszt friendship and the way Liszt took Chopin's works and transcribed them. You know, he adapted works. Even the Mephisto Waltz No. 1 that I'm ending the program with, the show-stopping piece, itself exists in different configurations, including Liszt's own orchestral version of the same work. So in music, to some extent, there's always been a sense of borrowing, a sense of building upon. And you fast forward to today, and it's really, you know, rampant in some of the most popular forms. You know, you look at dance music, DJs, hip hop. You know, there's a lot of sampling, a lot of borrowing, and it was these themes coming together that's what led me to conceive of this, you know, open source music festival.
So, what does that look like in practice? What is an open source music festival? I come as a listener. What am I going to experience?
You're going to experience a lot of new types of music, fantastic artists. It's a 3-day festival coming in December of this year, and there's also going to be an electronic component to it as well. So, you know, really trying to have artists collaborate. Also, there will be a crowdsourced component with you know online.
Yeah.
So we're really trying to push the boundaries on what it means to be a music festival and not be a simple top-down curated festival, but something that's more bottom-up and more collaborative.
For more with pianist Joel Fan, you can find him on his YouTube channel, Joel Fan Piano, or online, joelfanmusic.com. His CDs are available through Reference Recordings. And you can see him in person on January 22nd at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. That's this Sunday at First Congregational Church in Rapid City, brought to you by the Black Hills Chamber Music Society. Joel and I continued our conversation and talked about his advice for young musicians and what advice young musicians should ignore. You can find that full conversation online after the show, listen.sdpb.org. This Saturday, marches take place across the United States and the world under the umbrella of the Women's March on Washington, D.C. Several marches are scheduled for South Dakota. One of them is here in Vermilion. Joining me now in the studio, Suzanne Skirm and Caitlin Collier from Vermilion. Welcome, Suzanne. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Caitlin, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
So, what's the point of the Women's March on Washington? Caitlin, you want to start?
Sure. The point of the Women's March, coming as it is the day after the inauguration, is essentially to say we're still here and there are still issues that we care strongly about. This umbrella that you talked about covers women's rights as human rights, but also the rights of just about every group that's a little bit unsettled right now, whether it's people of color, immigrants, the disabled, any of those.
Environmental issues, anything that you are for.
So, Suzanne, what's the message that you're hoping to send by gathering and walking together?
Well, I think the message personally that I would like to send is that what Caitlin said, we are here, we are watching. There are things that we feel very strongly about that may come under attack, that we are not going to we're not going to allow this to happen. But I think the primary goal of the Women's March is to put a positive spin on the last 3 or 4 months. The election process unleashed so much hatred and negativity, and the Women's March on Washington has declared in their mission statement that part of their goal is to combat all this hatred and negativity that was unleashed during the campaign and during the election. And I think that's what we would like to show here in Vermilion, too. We're not marching so much against something as we are for something, things that we believe in, yeah. Unity, women's rights, rights of all people.
So how do you prepare for something like that? Are you how do you gather people from a very diverse background and sort of get that message to the group and then out to the greater state of South Dakota?
That is a great question. I'm not sure that we have figured it all out yet.
Yeah.
We started planning, the two of us, just kind of right after the election, and while I think we both have had some experience in organizing, we kind of had to start from scratch on this. So we did a Facebook event page, we've contacted friends, we've tried to contact the media, and that's pretty much what we've done. And I think we've been fairly successful for the limited amount of time that we had.
Yeah. What kind of responses have you been getting early on?
Early on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Early on, we didn't get a lot of response. It seems like, though, as time has gone on, especially this last week, we've gotten a lot of response to the Facebook page and a lot of people saying they're going to march. I think Caitlin said 130 people had said they were going to come,
yeah,
and march. So we're hoping this continues.
Yeah, what's the opportunity going forward of sort of gathering those people together, even in a collaborative? You're going to meet some new faces. Vermilion's a small town, but I'm sure you don't know everyone who shows up for that. What could come from this?
We are planning after the march, to kind of have an after march where there'll be some opportunities to explore that from signing up for legislative alerts for here in South Dakota, to doing a survey about where the participants would like to see us go into the future. We think that this is the first step and that we're kind of planning for the next 2 to 4 years as a group that needs to keep going.
Give me the details of, if I live in Vermilion, I want to participate in the Women's March, where do I show up?
You will show up at the United Church of Christ on the Main Street. From 12:30 on, we're meeting in the basement there. The march will start at 1 o'clock from the corner of Dakota and Main Street, and we'll march down Main Street and end at the Clay County Courthouse. And then we'll reconvene in the basement of the church to do various activities and have discussion and warm beverages.
Yes, in Rapid City and Sioux Falls, they're also having sort of companion marches to the Women's March on Washington in Rapid City, 9 to 11, Mountain Time, meet at 6th and Omaha. You're going to march to 6th and St. Joseph. And in Sioux Falls, meet at Calvary Cathedral, and that starts at 9 o'clock as well. SDPB will have reporters, Keely Biltina will be in Sioux Falls, and Victoria Wicks will be in Rapid City, and we'll bring you thoughts from them on Mondays in the moment. So Suzanne and Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
And after the break, artist Tammy Eagle Hunter is with us from Rapid City. You're listening to, from Eagle Butte, she joins us from. You're listening to In the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. Tammy Eagle Hunter is a Lakota artist and the youth programs director of the Cheyenne River Youth Project. She works with children to bring art into their daily lives, even as she creates her own work that conveys a message of cultural strength and resilience. You can see her art at the Sioux Indian Museum. The exhibition runs from January 20th to March 24th. An opening reception is scheduled for January 20th from 4 to 5 p.m. Tammy Eagle Hunter, welcome to In the Moment.
Hello, thank you.
I'm looking online at your extraordinary artworks, and it's just a small sampling that I can find on their website. And I noticed that you are largely self-taught. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit in how you have explored art and grown as an artist, largely following your own path.
I think what I work with a youth organization called Cheyenne River Youth Project, and I've been here for about 10 years now. And so I've explored art really because I work with kids. You know, we do a lot of arts and crafts projects with them, and we do different things over the years that I just started to kind of, I don't think I ever got into this to be an artist, and I never really considered myself as an artist. I think a lot of the times, you know, I started just painting banners for birthday parties and things like that. Really, really super simple, you know, doing stuff for Christmas and painting backgrounds on paper on the walls so that we could have a Grinch stole Christmas, you know, environment in our youth
right.
center. And it was super, super simple like that. And, you know, as we've taught our kids things, I learned things with them. And so I really just, I started painting about 3 years ago, and we had opened a cafe here, and we couldn't afford to, you know, decorate it. And so what our executive director asked us all to do was to paint a turtle. Mm. And I painted a turtle, and then I just couldn't stop, and I painted like 11 turtles. And what happened from there on is that I just realized like how much of a stress relief painting was for me. And, you know, sometimes with the kids I work with especially, we live extremely chaotic lives, you know. There's some dysfunctions that we have to go through and live through, and we sort of live in this constant chaos and survival mode and stress and worry. And what I noticed for myself when I paint, it's very calming. It's very therapeutic, and that was definitely something that I wanted to be able to show our kids what it can do for you. So I just kept painting, and the things that I want them to learn are things that I started to kind of convey into my own paintings. You know, I want them to be proud of their heritage. I want them to know who they are and be more than what the world sees of us, and to convey that message of strength when often that message isn't conveyed to the public. You know, I'm located on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, and, you know, a public opinion about that isn't always the best and brightest, and I don't want our kids to feel that way about themselves. And so finding ways to help them, you know, convey a stronger message was part of what I wanted to do through art too, you know, to show that we're more than what people think about us.
What does that do to someone when you have an awareness that other people have an opinion of you that's not a full formed, informed, you know, fully developed picture? How does that affect the kids?
Well, I think part of, like, the organization I work with, what I've learned and saw a lot is that, you know, our kids do face struggles and our kids do have to go through some things. But I, like, working with kids, I never wanted them to think that of themselves, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. And how can you do that when you're telling people they need help? And, you know, sometimes we do need help. Sometimes this picture is shown to the world to get help. I'm trying to help build strong kids. You know, I want them strong, and I want them positive, and I want them to know that they're powerful. How can you do that if you're sending another message out to the world? You know, so just finding a way to send a stronger message, I think, because we can't tell them how strong, wonderful, and powerful they are if we're telling the world that they're not. And
is there a moment, you know, is there a moment that you made the connection between what the potential of art and your own art in sort of projecting that cultural strength in the community and outward?
Well, for me, it was, I find, like, a lot of our kids are just artistically talented already. Like, yeah. Already, we are already just so incredibly talented. But you don't really know where that can take you or what you can do with it. Me, personally, I didn't know that I could do anything with that. I didn't know that I could create a picture and somebody would like it, and somebody would, you know, that could be something that I could use for a source of income, or I could use to send a message. I didn't know that. Hmm. So I think being able to, you know, I had to find that out myself, and I'm an adult. But being able to take that, you know, new knowledge and new experience and be able to tell our kids, you can do this. Like, you can become an artist, I suppose, if that's what you call it. And you can have your art seen on such a bigger scale, and you can talk about it, and people will, like, it can support you, and it can tell a bigger story of us here. Because so, we don't, like, I didn't know that myself, and being able to tell kids that now, it, I think, is an extreme, like, it's a great opportunity. I'm super thankful at the opportunity to not only showcase my art and something that I love to do, but to also show our kids. I'm like, we have an art program and art interns, and to be able to say to them, see, you know, like, I get to have an exhibition, you know, people are going to come and look at my art, and I could maybe sell it, and mm-hmm. you know, people, you can do that, you know, you can do that, I did it, you know. that's really super, I'm extremely thankful for that opportunity
to be seen and to be known, and then to carry that forward. Tammy Eagle Hunter, thank you so much for your time. The exhibition is at the Sioux Indian Museum in Rapid City. You can meet the artist at an opening reception on January 20th, that's tomorrow, from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Mountain Time. Tammy, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for allowing me to talk.